books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
In association with RNIB Talking Books, this is Read On, the audiobook show. Hello, I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today we have a bit of a TV special. From Love Island, we'll be chatting to Tasha Gurry. And from Race Across the World, we'll be talking to Trish Sale. All that plus some new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library coming up on today's Read On. Later in the show, we'll get the books of your life from Trish Sale from Race Across the World. But first up, Toby Davey spoke to Tasha Gurry. Disability campaigner and Love Island star Tasha Gurry recently visited the RNIB studios to record the introduction to Hits Different, a summer romance novel she wrote with Lizzie Huxley-Jones.
A note from Tasha, that's me. Dear listener, I'm so proud to share Hits Different with you, my debut novel co-written with Lizzie Huxley-Jones. It's a spicy summer romance set in Ibiza, but it's also about embracing our differences, surrounding ourselves with people who value us and learning to put ourselves first. I wanted to incorporate some of my own personal experiences into Cassie's story. And so she's deaf, wears a cochlear implant, and dreams of becoming a professional dancer. Sounds familiar, right? There are lots of elements of me in Cassie, but she's also completely her own character. And this book is about her journey to find herself and self-love. I always believe you can't love somebody else unless you love yourself first. Cassie overcomes many obstacles along the way, including kissing some folks who don't fully appreciate her or bother to learn about her disability. But with the support of her friends, including her non-binary bestie Pen and Levi, who truly loves her for her, she's able to achieve her dreams. She has to make some hard choices, but she realises she has to because her happiness comes first. It's been amazing to work with Lizzie, who I share so many similar experiences with, and who has made the process of publishing my first book so special. We had the same vision of what we wanted to achieve with Cassie's story. It's been incredible to bring it to life together. First and foremost, Hits Different is romance. But perhaps you'll find that it's taught you something too, about cochlear implants and how to approach people with disabilities, about pronouns and being a good ally. And maybe even about how to love yourself for who you are. I'll now leave you with our brilliant narrator to bring Cassie's story to life. I hope you enjoy listening to it. Lots of love, Tasha.
The audio version of Hits Different is read by Eve Von Elg.
I've been dancing my whole life. There's nothing like the rush of nailing every step, every flick of a hand in a new dance routine. I can lose myself in the movement of my body, in the way the beat feels in my chest, the satisfaction I get from every perfectly timed move. In that moment, everything else in life falls away. When my body is in motion, I feel free. I feel me. But it's a secret from the rest of the world. It's just for me. My phone is precariously propped against the window frame, which just about gets the right angles for filming my routines. It doesn't have to be perfectly shot anyway because I never show them to anyone. I flop onto the bed and watch back the video. It took me all morning to get the choreography down for Shiny's track Lucifer, and I actually look pretty good. Sure, dancing routines solo when they're usually performed by a group of five people is a totally different vibe, but I think I did a good job of adapting the choreography. My arms could snap sharper, and I spy one of my feet lagging a bit as the beat changes, but I style it out enough that I don't think anyone but me would even notice. I'm a perfectionist. There's always room for improvement, but it's good enough for now.
You join me here on RNIB Connect Radio in our London studios with Tasha Gurry, television personality, activist, model and social media influencer. As a proud cochlear implant wearer, Tasha is also a global ambassador for Deaf Kids UK and works with the National Deaf Children's Society and the RNID to help other people who have hearing impairments. Tasha has just recorded an exclusive introduction to her debut sizzling summer romance novel, Hits Different, co-written with Lizzie Huxley-Jones, available in the RNIB Talking Books library. Hello, Tasha, and welcome to RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Hits Different, I believe, Tasha, is based on your own experiences as a deaf dancer. And I wondered how close Cassie, the main character in the books, her story and experiences are to your own life.
I think with Cassie, we kind of wanted to have elements of my experiences and a bit of my personality in there. And representation is so important, especially with books. I don't really see that. Even growing up, I didn't have that representation of anyone who was deaf or were cochrane plan in any kind of young adult book or even children books. So with Cassie, she's really special and she really finds self-love as well as finding love. And that's what's really beautiful about her journey, is the fact that she's also trying to learn how to love herself and love her disability and love her cochlear implant, her deafness. And then this beautiful man, Levi, walks in, and she was in a toxic relationship before. He didn't care about her deafness, wasn't interested, but Levi comes in. And he's a bit like Andrew, actually. And he's got elements where he really loves her for her and wants to learn about her deafness. So it really has elements of me in there, which I think is really, really beautiful.
You should read through the info on the advert and have a proper think about it. Which I guess you've already done. A deadpan. Naturally, darling. I'm nosy, they say, and I laugh despite myself. But really, have a look. There's a bit in it about how they're encouraging applications from dancers from underrepresented backgrounds. Pen, I don't think they need any more slim white girls. I laugh. You know that's not what I mean. I say, staring at the article again and running my finger along my hairline to my cochlear implant. If it was anyone else saying this to me, I would feel weird, but Penn's known me so long and they know what it's like to be visibly different from everyone else. Just do an application, they insist. What's the worst that can happen? I embarrass myself, I say seriously. Okay, that doesn't sound too bad in the grand scheme of things, does it?
And I suppose for many people, including blind and partially sighted people, sort of growing up with a disability, it's quite hard when you're trying to sort of, you know, sort of grow up and find yourself and develop as a sort of, you know, teenager into adulthood, and having people around you that sort of, I suppose, accept you for what you are and who you are.
Absolutely. I think growing up as well, you're kind of trying to figure out who you are as a person. You've got so much going on. And it's a pivotal moment in your life, I guess. You know, you're thinking about the future, your career. And I think at the time, once again, it stems down to representation on TV, even the beauty industry. There wasn't any of that. And the fact that, you know, anyone with a disability had no one to look up to, we felt lonely. I felt lonely many times, felt isolated, the fact that there was no one that could relate. And it was tough sometimes. And I think for me, dancing actually massively helped with my confidence and helped me think about who I was, because it's such a safe space, and I felt like I could go dance for an hour and a half and be the Tasha that I wanted to be, and no one would care or judge. And, you know, that's from then, that's where I really started to learn to embrace my deafness and really love that part of myself.
What did sort of other people think about you as a deaf person wanting to do dance? Because I think it might be a little bit similar to blind and partially sighted people who get involved in the arts, in the visual arts, in painting and photography, because some people might sort of think, well, somebody can't see very well. Why would they want to get involved in the visual arts, which might be similar to what people might think of deaf people wanting to get into dance?
Oh, I 100% see what you mean. There's stigma around. There's actually sometimes where people would say, how is she in time for music if she can't hear? And it was a bit like, well, I can hear, I'm wearing a cochlear implant. And there was quite a lot of those comments around on social media. And I kind of just had to educate. And that's what I use my platform for, is to actually turn it into a positive and just educate people and say, look, I can hear. And the way I feel music's very different. I actually feel it through my body, the vibrations, which I think is awesome. And I hear music very differently to other people. I can't hear the lyrics. I won't know what they're saying unless I go and Google and learn it. But apart from that, I really have to go off the beat and the rhythm and how it feels in my body. So that's why I love dancing as well. I love music and the way I feel it. But there is such a stigma sometimes, in even in any kind of industry, that we're kind of perceived on what we can and can't do, when actually that's not the case. It makes us no less able, like you said, with photography and art, and that's the beauty of it, I think.
And Tasha, you were the first deaf contestant to appear on Love Island. And how much do you think being so was a sort of breakthrough for disability awareness in a mainstream TV series like Love Island, which is sort of watched by teenagers, people in their 20s and 30s?
It was a tough one, I think. I think it was definitely a breakthrough for sure, absolutely. I think all the headlines were going crazy for it. But I think coming out of it, there was still a lot needs to be done. I think putting myself in such a vulnerable position on live TV, one of the biggest shows watched in the UK and even around the world, it was definitely hard, but I'm glad I did it because, you know, once again, it's like representation of no one's ever done that. And I wanted to be the first person and show people that you can be confident, you can find love, you can chat to people and people will accept you for who you are. But there's a lot of ableism that still happens, unfortunately. That's probably one of the negatives I suffered from being on Love Island.
And did you take any of your experiences in Love Island into Hits Different?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Hits Different, it's basically summer novel romance. It's set in Ibiza and it's really got that Love Island element of it. You know, it's abroad, you're in a different country. And it feels like a movie. When you're reading it, it feels like you're like kind of like a movie set kind of vibe. So it really does have elements of Love Island in there.
Recently, you posted on TikTok a sort of get ready with me edit of your sort of daily routine without your cochlear implants in. And as you say, it was a sort of way of showing people the true Tasha. And I wondered how important it was for you to be able to show people through TikTok the sort of, you know, the true Tasha, as you say.
I think it was definitely a special moment for myself. I wasn't ready to do that straight after Love Island. I wasn't ready to showcase that part of myself. I wanted to do it when I was ready. And I just thought, when I get ready, half the time I actually don't wear my cochlear implant. On the morning and night time, I won't have it in. And when I'm getting ready, I have it out. And I just kept thinking to myself, I'm putting it in just to do a video. And I actually wanted to start showing, like you said, the true Tasha and start normalising deaf accents. Because on the show, a lot of people really brought me down because of my voice and the way I speak. And that's why I did what I did, because that, once again, is educating people that probably didn't even know. So that's why I took that chance to really be, you know, show that this is who I really am. And the amount of positive love that I got really showed that how much it needed to happen.
And I think that's sort of similar to blind and partially sighted young people who start to sort of lose their sight a bit and have to use a white cane for sort of mobility. And it must be really hard for them, because with a white cane, people see you a lot more and you obviously must be a little bit more conscious of other people looking at you. And I wondered if that's the sort of same with deaf and hard of hearing people as well.
Yeah, I guess so. I think when I was growing up, I was definitely more conscious. I would wear my hair down. I wouldn't even want to show my cochlear implant. I was very scared to even talk about it. I think eventually I just kind of had to learn and find that confidence within myself. And you are going to get judged 24/7. People will love you. People will not like you. And that's what I had to learn, especially in this industry. You do kind of have to be very tough and strong on the outside as well as the inside. And you need to focus on the positive and focus on people that do love you and do give you that positivity. So when I was growing up, I always had a very small circle. Even now, my friends are very small, my family, but that's because I surround myself with people that will lift me up and pick me up the floor when I need to be getting off the floor and be grounded. So I think that's probably my advice actually for people out there. Surround yourself with people that really uplift and support you.
And it's great to have people like yourself, Tasha, and a number of blind and partially sighted social influencers out there who are proud of their disability, which must be really good for young people and old people with disabilities to see people like yourself out there just being yourselves.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. And I think it's really important to have these kind of voices out there. And like you said, anyone with any kind of disability, you know, use your voice as much as you can, because you never know how much of an impact you have on other people.
And as someone, Tasha, who has just co-written your first debut summer sizzler novel, Hits Different, is there a book from your childhood that sort of, in a way, made you sort of fall in love with reading and writing?
Yes, I do. So I actually used to read these fairy books. I don't know if anyone remembers them, but they were called Rainbow Magic Books. It's written by Daisy Meadows. And basically, each book had different fairies and it had about different characters about them. I remember I used to literally collect for probably about 3 bookshelves, all in order and colour order as well. So that's my like childhood go-to, my books.
"Look, Dad," said Rachel Walker. She pointed across the blue-green sea at the rocky island ahead of them. The ferry was sailing towards it, dipping up and down on the rolling waves. "Is that Rainspell Island?" she asked. Her dad nodded.
"Yes, it is," he said, smiling. "Our holiday is about to begin."
The waves slapped against the side of the ferry as it bobbed up and down on the water. Rachel felt her heart thump with excitement. She could see white cliffs and emerald green fields on the island, and golden sandy beaches with rock pools dotted here and there. Suddenly, a few fat raindrops plopped down onto Rachel's head. "Oh!" she gasped, surprised. The sun was still shining. Rachel's mum grabbed her hand. "Let's get undercover," she said, leading Rachel inside. "Isn't that strange?" Rachel said. "Sunshine and rain."
That's Beth Chalmers reading from Ruby the Red Fairy by Daisy Meadows, book 1 in the Rainbow Magic series. Available, as are many other Rainbow Magic books, from the RNIB library.
And do you have a rainy day comfort reread book that you'll go back to time and time again?
This is probably a bit of a cringe-worthy one, but Bridgerton. I love the Netflix series, but the book I actually found was more in-depth about their relationship, and I just really, really loved how raw it was.
The Bridgertons are by far the most prolific family in the upper echelons of society. Such industriousness on the part of the Viscountess and the late Viscount is commendable, although one can find only banality in their choice of names for their children. Anthony, Benedict, Colin, Daphne, Eloise, Francesca, Gregory, and Hyacinth. Orderliness is, of course, beneficial in all things. But one would think that intelligent parents would be able to keep their children straight without needing to alphabetize their names. Furthermore, the sight of the Viscountess and all 8 of her children in one room is enough to make one fear one is seeing double, or triple, or worse.
Sally Burnett, reading from The Duke and I, Bridgerton Book 1 by Julia Quinn, available from RNIB Talking Books.
And is there a book that you've recently read that you would recommend to listeners?
The Summer I Turned Pretty. There's actually a series on Amazon Prime as well, but the book as well is really, really nice. It's really, once again, about the characters more highlighted, so it's probably a little nice little summer one for you guys.
We'd been driving for about 7,000 years, or at least that's how it felt. My brother, Stephen, drove slower than our grandma. I sat next to him in the passenger seat with my feet up on the dashboard. Meanwhile, my mother was passed out in the back seat. Even when she slept, she looked alert, like at any second she could wake up and direct traffic. "Go faster," I urged Stephen, poking him in the shoulder. "Let's pass that kid on the bike." Stephen shrugged me off. "Never touch the driver," he said, "and take your dirty feet off my dashboard." I wiggled my toes back and forth. They looked pretty clean to me. "It's not your dashboard. It's going to be my car soon, you know." "If you ever get your license," he scoffed. "People like you shouldn't even be allowed to drive." "Hey, look," I said, pointing out the window. "That guy in the wheelchair just lapped us." Stephen ignored me, and so I started to fiddle with the radio. One of my favorite things about going to the beach was the radio stations. I was as familiar with them as I was with the ones back home, and listening to Q94 made me just really know inside that I was there, at the beach.
Lola Tung, reading from The Summer I Turned Pretty by Jenny Han, available commercially.
Well, I'm sure lots of listeners will be listening to Hits Different as they jet off for their summer holidays, or maybe just listening to a hot read during the summer. What would you like listeners to sort of gain, I suppose, from reading Hits Different? What would you like people to sort of get out of it?
think what I would like readers to get from Hits Different is, you know, embrace your disability. If you're queer, embrace that as well. And there's a non-binary person in there, and it's really about representation of all the different characters. And I think what I want people to really take from it is trust your journey, trust your process, be patient, hang in there. And trust me, you will find the right path that's right for you, and you will find your self-confidence and self-love within, and literally you'll spread your wings and you'll fly.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Tasha Gurry, for chatting with me here on RNIB Connect Radio and telling me more about It's Different.
Thank you so much.
A voice in my mind says, it would be worse to not try and never find out. My stomach is filled with butterflies and I don't even know why. I'm not seriously considering this, am I? Sure, when I was a little kid, I dreamed of being a dancer. But it's not like I've kept up going to dance classes, so the fact I work a minimum wage job has something to do with that. I've not been to an actual dance class since my first cochlear implant broke, and I couldn't face trying when I couldn't hear anything. And it's about more than just filling out one application. I'm worried it would open a Pandora's box of questions about my future. Besides, I love my life in York with Penn and Mason. And being a kitchen porter is easy for me. Every day is the same, and I'm a hard worker, so I get the job done, even if it's sticky and smelly and often gross. No one bothers me back there, and I don't have to talk to customers. Sure, it might not be what I want to do long term, but the fact the chefs will prepare whatever I want for lunch makes up for it a little bit. I'll work out something realistic I want to do eventually. It's fine for now.
Hits Different by Tasha Gurry and Lizzie Huxley-Jones is narrated by Yvonne Elg and available commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. Thanks again to Tasha and Toby. Hits Different is now in the RNIB Talking Books library. And talking of which,
thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books library. So here are two new gems. A Gentleman in Moscow was recently on TV with Ewan McGregor in the lead role. Its best-selling author, Amor Towles, has written a new short story collection. Table for Two was donated by Penguin Random House.
A few years before the end of the millennium, one Timothy Touchett sat in the main reading room of the New York Public Library's Fifth Avenue branch with a copy of Maxwell Perkins's collected letters before him. What had brought this young man from the suburbs of Boston to such a majestic spot on a sunlit afternoon? Better yet, what had brought him to New York in the first place? Quite simply, his determination since childhood to become a celebrated novelist. With his bachelor's degree from a well-regarded liberal arts college firmly in hand, he had set out for that city where countless luminaries had pounded the pavement and burned the midnight oil. He moved in with Dan, an aspiring actor from NYU who needed a new roommate in his East Village sublet. He got a job as a waiter in an Italian restaurant. He bought composition books, pens, and paper for his typewriter. Despite the fact that this story takes place more than a decade after the rise of the personal computer.
The millions of readers of Amor Towles are in for a treat as he shares some of his shorter fiction, six stories set in New York City and a novella in Los Angeles. The New York stories, most of which are set around the turn of the millennium, take up everything from the death-defying acrobatics of the male ego to the fateful consequences of brief encounters and the delicate mechanics of compromise, which operate at the heart of modern marriages. In Towles' novel Rules of Civility, the indomitable Evelyn Ross leaves New York City in September 1938 with the intention of returning home to Indiana. But as her train pulls into Chicago, where her parents are waiting, she instead extends her ticket to Los Angeles. Told from seven points of view, Eve in Hollywood describes how Eve crafts a new future for herself and others in the midst of Hollywood's golden age. Throughout the stories, two characters often find themselves sitting across a table for two, where the direction of their futures may hinge upon what they say to each other next. Written with his signature wit, humour and sophistication, Table for Two is another glittering addition to Towell's canon of stylish and transporting historical fiction.
Many young authors finding themselves so satisfactorily situated would have waded into the choppy seas of their ambitions without a moment's delay, using their free hours to spin sentences into paragraphs and paragraphs into pages, melding memories and fancies with immediate impressions until their first novel was ready for its miraculous debut. But having spent a few weeks tapping his pencil on the top of his desk, Timothy decided that before he began this endeavor in earnest, it behooved him to study the practices of his heroes. How did they approach their craft? Did they write in the morning or at night? Sober or intoxicated? Did they outline with care or allow their prose to unfurl before them like a red carpet before the procession of a king? All the finest composers and architects have studied the craftsmanship of the masters before setting out in search of their own inimitable style. Or so Timothy opined to Susie, the abstract expressionist from Oberlin who lived down the hall. But in sharing this sensible view, Timothy was not being completely honest with his neighbor. He was not being completely honest with himself. For what had caused Timothy to delay the start of his novel was not a desire to investigate methodologies, but a fear, so dark and disturbing it could barely be acknowledged. The fear that he had no story to tell.
Table for Two by Amor Towles is read by Eduardo Ballery and J. Smith Cameron and runs for 13 hours and 24 minutes.
For those interested in warfare, we have Sword Beach by Stephen Fisher, which was given to us by Penguin Random House.
In the swirling waters off the coast of Normandy, 3.7 nautical miles north of the seaside town of Oustrême, a dark metal hull suddenly broke the surface. Pitching and rolling in the swell, it did not look like any conventional boat. Had anyone been around to see it, they might have mistaken it for wreckage. But even if someone had been around, it is doubtful that any but the keenest eyes would have seen this small object, even if it surfaced directly underneath them. A storm swept across the English Channel, and dark clouds blotted out almost everything around. Barely a foot above the surface, and with the waves breaking over it every few seconds, this diminutive little vessel was almost invisible.
Filling a massive gap in D-Day literature, marine historian Stephen Fisher provides fresh insight and unrivaled coverage of one of the least well-known of the D-Day landings. Although they are well-known, coverage of the action on Sword, Juno and Gold Beaches is relatively sparse and overshadowed by the more famous American landing at Omaha. In fact, the capture of all the beaches were events in their own right, full of drama and incident, and in particular, Sword Beach turned out to be crucial in securing the Normandy landings.
Inside, hands weakened by inactivity grasped a wheel. With a creak, it turned until a slight hiss emanated as the airtight seal was broken. The hatch was thrown open, and an exhausted figure clambered up and flopped his torso out onto the narrow deck. Cold sea air rushed into the interior of HMS X-23, followed by a cascade of spray. Feeling a little giddy from the rush of fresh air in his lungs, the midget submarine's commander, Lieutenant George Honor, lowered himself back through the hatch. The other four occupants of X-23 lounged on the cramped deck within, breathing in the fresh air. But there was no time to lose. Once the stale, repugnant atmosphere inside the submarine, the result of more than 19 hours underwater, had blown away, the hatches were closed and the submarine's motor was started up. Dead reckoning navigation had led them to the coast in darkness, and, having taken several position fixes through the magnified periscope during daylight hours, Lieutenant Geoffrey Lynn, RN, part of Combined Operations Pilotage Party, COPP, number 9, had worked out their exact location from landmarks on the shore. Oustrême's lighthouse and church, along with the spires of the churches at Longrun, Douvres-la-Délivrande and Saint-Aubin-d'Arcony, revealed them to be a mere 1,000 yards from their intended target. Quickly, the submarine motored northwest on the last leg of its mission and dropped its anchor. Cautiously, the hatches were opened again, enough to let the tiniest amount of cool night air filter into the submarine's compact interior. It was sufficient. Any fresh air was an improvement on the thick, foul fog that prevailed. On the outside, X-23 was 51 feet long, but inside, the crew had a cabin barely 8 by 5 feet and just under 6 feet high. The only way to survive such a long period underwater was to periodically release pure oxygen, increasing the air pressure each time they did so. With so little space, there had been no chance of any strenuous activity. Conversation and anything that might use up precious air was kept to an absolute minimum anyway, and smoking was impossible. All the submarine's 5 occupants had been able to do was lie on the cramped deck and hope to sleep.
Sword Beach by Stephen Fisher is read by Rory Alexander and runs for 15 hours and 20 minutes. We'll have 2 more books after this.
This is an RNIB talking book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. Some of the feedback received by the Talking Book Studios over the years can be a bit unusual.
We get a lot of fan letters from our readers. We get a lot of thanks from our readers as well, which is really lovely to hear. I remember one story. One gentleman wrote to us, complained about the books we were sending him. We used to put a little asterisk by the catalogue number when there was a warning put onto the book, you know, warnings that there was bad language or some passages that may not be considered suitable for family listening. So we used to put a little warning on it on the recording, and we used to put a little asterisk by the print catalogue so people, if they saw that, they could say, well, I don't want to listen to that. And we had one gentleman write to us and say, I'm disgusted. Every single book you send me, from beginning to end, it's full of filth. Now, you do notice what I've said there, from beginning to end. So he read the book first, then decided to complain about it. What we discovered lately is that he wasn't selecting the books, his carer was selecting the books, and she thought these asterisks were books that we were recommending.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio. This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy a book for the younger listener or young at heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
In a moment, we'll hear from Trish Sale about her time on Race Across the World, and she's got some book recommendations. But first, let's return to Lynn Livingston for 2 more brand new books.
Historical Gothic fantasy has become very popular, with Bridget Collins being one of its best-selling authors. Her latest is The Silence Factory, which was donated by HarperCollins.
Last night I could hear them again. They make so little noise that I do not understand how it can carry through the corridors of this house. But carry it does. It is hard enough to sleep, gravid and swollen as I am, and once I hear it I cannot turn my thoughts away from it. So when that silken whisper began to tug at me, I dragged myself to my feet to answer the summons. I drew on a wrapper because the half-hearted English summer night did not warm me past the top of my skin, and padded on naked feet down the stairs and through the dim passages until I came into the orangery. The moon was full, dazzling among the foliage of the olive and lemon trees, glinting through the stinking juniper. If it had not been for the walls and windows, I might have thought myself transported, and I caught myself thinking, home. But that Mediterranean island was not home. It was never home, no matter how much I longed to belong there, no matter how I yearned to lose myself forever in the midday shade of the evergreen forests. I should have remembered that I am an Englishwoman, a Christian, alien and pale-skinned, and above all, James's wife. If I had held tight to those undeniable facts, if I had kept faith, then... Oh, but it is done. It is over. It is no good now.
Henry dreams of silence, a world without the clattering of carriages through cobbled streets, the distant cries of drunken brawls, the relentless ticking of the clock. Then he meets a fascinating, mysterious gentleman who sells just that. Precious silk that can drown out the clamour of the world and everything Henry is so desperate to escape. Summoned to Sir Edward's secluded factory to try to cure his young daughter's deafness, Henry is soon drawn deeper and deeper into the origins of this otherworldly gift, a gift that has travelled from ancient Mediterranean glades to English libraries. Ignoring repeated warnings from the girl's secretive governess, he allows himself to fall under the spell of Sir Edward and his silk. But when he learns its true cost, will it be too late to turn back?
I stood shivering and barefoot on the threshold, staring at the shimmer of reflections at the far end of the room, where the glass cases stand half concealed by the greenery. The moonlight and shadows were so deceptive that I could make out nothing but my own wan face peering back at me through leaves, my thin shoulders and bony neck above the shocking mass of my breasts and belly. It was not until I stepped forward into a band of darkness, erasing myself, that I could make out the contents of the nearest vivarium, the branches dry on the dead stones, the scatter of fallen pine needles, the scabrous bundles that hung like limbed fruit from the webs that spanned from one side to the other. I could smell putrefaction. The sound that had woken me grew louder. Or did it? Perhaps it was an illusion. Perhaps it is always, ever an illusion. And seemed to swirl about the room, coming from new directions, or from every direction at once. It is neither a song nor a susurrus, not a call nor a creak nor a command. And yet it is all of those. It cut my breath and made my innards roil. I found my legs carrying me towards the tank until I was barely a hand's width from the glass.
The Silence Factory by Bridget Collins is read by Ned Porteous and runs for 11 hours and 13 minutes.
For lovers of true crime, we have The Mysterious Mrs. Hood by Kim Donovan, which was donated by Seven Dials.
At 6:10 on the morning of Sunday, the 23rd of September, 1900, 14-year-old John Norton left his house on Boreham Road and made his way to Great Yarmouth South Beach. John worked as an attendant at Hewitt's bathing chalet under the watchful eye of the caretaker, Mr. Grief. After a busy summer season, the long warm days that had attracted the bathers to the seaside resort were beginning to fade away. As the sun began to rise sluggishly in the east, the young lad walked along the new road before joining South Parade, the roadway that ran parallel to the coast. He squinted out across the beach. As his eyes adjusted to the increasing light, he noticed what looked like a bundle of garments lying in the hollow of one of the dunes. The heap was partially concealed by the long marram grass that grew in tufts along the stretch of beach closest to the parade. This part of town had been largely untouched by development, and its secluded nature made it popular with courting couples. Curious, John jumped down from the raised path of the parade and climbed across the dunes to investigate. His feet sank into the sand, and the golden flower spikes of the marram grass brushed against his legs. When he reached the bundle of clothing a few seconds later, John found himself standing over the lifeless body of a young woman. He stared at her bruised face before noticing the bootlace
that was tied tightly around her neck. Her eyes were wide and sightless. In a panic, John turned and scrambled back up the beach. He ran desperately along Marine Parade until he reached the jetty. It was there, standing by the lifeboat station, that he stumbled across PC Edwin Manship. Breathing heavily from shock and exertion, John relayed the news of his grim discovery. A few minutes later, with PC Manship by his side, he found himself gazing down at the unfortunate woman for a second time.
Great Yarmouth, September 1900. A young woman is found dead on the beach, a bootlace tied tightly around her neck. She's quickly traced to a lodging house and identified as Mrs. Hood, a visitor to the town with her small child. But, despite her death attracting national attention in the press, nobody claims her. D.I. Robert Lingwood of the Great Yarmouth Police Force is assigned to the case and declares he will not rest until the mystery of the young woman's death is solved. The curious case of Mrs. Hood is decreed a Sherlock Holmes mystery in the scandal-hungry, crime-obsessed press. Only once the case has been referred to Scotland Yard do the layers of mystery start to peel away. Following clues and tracking red herrings leads the police to close in on their one and only suspect. With arson, fraud, an affair, and a sensation-hungry press, the murder gripped the nation in one of the most eagerly anticipated trials of the early 20th century.
The police constable swiftly took charge of the scene, sending John off to fetch a horse and cart from the local carter and fish transporter, William Woods, at 59 Ordnance Road. PC Manship was an observant yet inexperienced officer. He had left the Royal Navy 3.5 years earlier to join the Great Yarmouth Police Force, where he had received little formal training, as was standard at the time. England's first modern police force, the Metropolitan Police Service, had been established in 1829 by Home Secretary Sir Robert Peel and replaced the previous system of parish constables and watchmen. The success of the Metropolitan Police Service led to the establishment of the County Police Act 10 years later. The Norfolk Rural Police Force was the first of its kind and was well established by the time the County and Borough Police Act made county police forces compulsory in 1856. Its jurisdiction was divided into 12 areas, each supervised by a superintendent, with 120 PCs covering the whole county. By 1900, the number of police officers in England, Wales and Scotland totaled 46,800, working in 243 separate forces. At this time, the Great Yarmouth Borough Police Force was led by Chief Constable Parker, a solid, broad-shouldered man in his early 50s. Parker was also superintendent of the Fire Brigade, Inspector of Hackney Carriages and Inspector of Fish.
The Mysterious Mrs. Hood by Kim Donovan is read by Lucy Scott and runs for 10 hours and 35 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
50% reality game show and 50% exotic travel series, the BBC's Race Across the World, Season 3, was won by Tricia Sale and Cathy Rowe. Tricia works for RNIB, and while I was interviewing her for an event that actually ended up not happening, we chatted about her time on Race Across the World, and I asked her for the books of her life for Read On. That's coming up in a moment, but first I asked Tricia about her sight condition.
So I've got a genetic disease called chromoretinopathy uveitis. The nickname for it is called birdshot. So it's basically my immune system attacking my eyes, saying they don't belong to me anymore. It's a very rare genetic disease, and it's just the way I was made up, unfortunately. But you kind of learn to live with it. I had 20/20 vision up until 13 years ago, and then all of a sudden it decided to rear its ugly head and started losing my sight.
Now, you do work for RNIB. What's your job within the organisation?
I do work for RNIB. I started in November 2022. I'm a community connections coordinator. So what I do is go around doing site awareness sessions to the general public, to organisations and other charities, showing and helping people to learn how to guide sight impaired people. I go to WI meetings, Rotaries, macular groups, and talk about the services for RNIB. But what I also do, which is main job, is speak to individuals that have started on their sight loss journey and help them become as independent as they possibly can by getting them the help that they need. So whether that's benefit advice, whether it's mobility advice, whether it's making use of our group networks that we have. So we do have things such as tech groups, we've got chat groups, we've got all sorts of groups of like-minded people that come together and just chat about what they like. So that's a main part of my job, and I absolutely love it. I get to speak to a lot of sight impaired people and get to eat lots of cake. So it's great fun.
Now, what was the thinking behind applying for Race Across the World?
I don't think there was any thinking behind applying for Race Across the World. Not really. Myself and Kathy get ourselves into lots of mischief anyway. But I'd seen Series 1 and Series 2 and thought it was an absolutely brilliant concept. And I love travelling. And I wouldn't do it with anybody but Kathy, because she's basically my guide dog. She hates me saying that, but she is my eyes. And we've done a lot of crazy things together. So we've walked 100 kilometres non-stop. So I trust her with my life. So I saw after Series 2, it said, if you want to apply here. So I did. And then after I applied, I phoned Kathy and went, can you do a 1 minute video? And she went, what about? I said, why you want to do this with me? And she went, oh, okay. And then it's only after we'd gone through a few of the interview stages and things like that, she said, I think I might need to actually watch this programme and find out what it's all about. So, yeah, she always says that I get her into a lot of trouble, but I think it's the other way around as well. It was just great fun. It's a brilliant concept, having just ordinary people doing extraordinary things, you know, things that they would never be able to do, but also racing against other people. So yeah, I just thought it looked like fun.
Did the producers have to make any alterations because of your sight loss, or did they leave you to it?
They're very, very accommodating at Studio Lambert and the BBC. They didn't have to make any adjustments for me, to be fair, because I'm used to my sight loss now and I've kind of learnt ways of getting around things. But they were very good in saying, can I do this, rather than, oh, you can't do that because you're blind. Whereas I come across it a lot in my life, or did, very much, oh, you can't do that because your eyesight, you can't do this because your eyesight. Whereas Studio Lambert and everybody that was involved in the Race Across the World were very much like, well, can you do it? And I was like, well, I'll give it a go. Yeah, so, I mean, they did things like ask me if I needed any large print stuff or anything like that. And I was like, well, no, actually, we need to be on an even keel with the other groups, the other teams. Kathy is my eyesight anyway, so they didn't really need to do any changing of anything as such. They just had to be more aware that if I had a panic attack because of my anxiety that comes along with my eyesight, that they knew what to do about it.
And you did get into the gondola at the end.
Yeah, that gondola. Oh, my word. I think when I read that we were going in a gondola, I had images of being, you know, in Venice on a gondola. I didn't think it was kind of the Canadian way of saying a cable car. And I'm petrified of heights. I won't even look at my second story in the house because I'm that petrified of heights. Oh, it was horrendous. But I did it. And I've done a few since. So, yes, I think I'm not over my height phobia, but I'm getting there.
Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Yes, actually, there was. There's a couple of books. My first ever memory of reading was an Enid Blyton book, which was The Faraway Tree and Mr. Moon Man. And I still to this day, every time I think of the Moon Man, it makes me put a big smile on my face. It just made me realise I wanted to read.
There were once three children, called Joe, Beth and Franny. All their lives they had lived in a town, but now their father had a job in the country, so they were all to move as soon as they possibly could. "What fun to be in the country," said Joe. "I shall learn all about animals and birds."
"And I shall pick as many flowers as I want to," said Beth.
"And I shall have a garden of my own," said Franny.
When the day came for the move, all the children were excited. A small van came to the door, and two men helped their father and mother to pile everything into it. When it was full, the van drove away, and the children put on their coats and hats to go with their mother to the station to catch a train.
"Now we're off," cried Joe.
"The country, the country," sang Beth.
"We might see fairies there," said Franny.
The train whistled and chuffed out of the station. The children pressed their noses to the window and watched the dirty houses and the chimneys race by. How they hated the town! How lovely it would be to be in the clean country, with flowers growing everywhere and birds singing in the hedges.
"We might have adventures in the country," said Joe. "There will be streams and hillsides, big fields and dark woods. Ooh, it will be lovely."
"You won't have any more adventures in the country than you will have in the town," said their father. "I dare say you will find it all very dull." But that's where he was quite wrong. My goodness, the things that happened to those three children.
That's Mark Straker reading from The Enchanted Wood, Faraway Tree, Book 1, by Enid Blyton. Available from RNIB Talking Books.
Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
One as I got a little bit older was Flowers in the Attic. There was a series of three, I think it was, by Virginia Andrews. And I just loved the series. They were very well written, or I thought they were at the time.
Truly, when I was very young, way back in the 50s, I believed all of life would be like one long and perfect summer day. After all, it did start out that way. There's not much I can say about our earliest childhood, except that it was very good, and for that I should be everlastingly grateful. We weren't rich, we weren't poor. If we lacked some necessity, I couldn't name it. If we had luxuries, I couldn't name those either without comparing what we had to what others had, and nobody had more or less in our middle-class neighbourhood. In other words, short and simple, we were just ordinary, run-of-the-mill children. Our daddy was a PR man for a large computer manufacturing firm located in Gladstone, Pennsylvania. Population 12,602. He was a huge success, our father. For often his boss dined with us and bragged about the job Daddy seemed to perform so well. "Is that all-American, wholesome, devastatingly good-looking face and charming manner that does them in? Great God in heaven, Chris, what sensible person could resist a fella like you?" Heartily I agreed with that. Our father was perfect. He stood 6'2", weighed 180 pounds, and his hair was thick and flaxen blonde and waved just enough to be perfect. His eyes were cerulean blue, and they sparkled with laughter, with his great zest for living and having fun. His nose was straight and neither too long, nor too narrow, nor too thick. He played tennis and golf like a pro and swam so much he kept a suntan all through the year. He was always dashing off on airplanes to California, to Florida, to Arizona, or to Hawaii, or even abroad on business, while we were left at home in the care of our mother. When he came through the front door, late on Friday afternoons, every Friday afternoon. He said he couldn't bear to be separated from us for longer than 5 days. Even if it was raining or snowing, the sun shone when he beamed his broad, happy smile on us. His booming greeting rang out as soon as he put down his suitcase and briefcase. "Come and greet me with kisses if you love me." Somewhere near the front door, my brother and I would be hiding. And after he'd called out his greeting, we'd dash out from behind a chair or the sofa to crash into his wide-open arms, which seized us up at once and held us close, and he warmed our lips with his kisses. Fridays. They were the best days of all.
Nina Holloway reading from Flowers in the Attic by Virginia Andrews, available in the RNIB Library.
And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
I am actually listening at the moment to a book called Life-Changing Magic of Not Giving a Beep. And it's really good. It's one that was handed around while we're on the race across the world, apart from myself, because it was in book form. And so I started listening to it on the audio, and it's really good, really good.
Things. As discussed, the things category deals with inanimate objects and concepts, neither of which possess the irksome feelings and opinions of your fellow human beings. True, some items on your things list might technically be people. I consider the Grateful Dead a thing, for example, though it takes the form of human bodies. And they might also technically qualify as strangers. I don't personally know any members of the Grateful Dead. But when I say strangers, I really mean people you've encountered, but whom you don't actually know. Like that guy on your vacation who's trying really hard to get you to sign up for the timeshare sales pitch. And you're like, "Guy, I don't give a about timeshares or about whether you make your quotas." Although, I guess if you already put timeshares on your things list, then guy selling timeshares doesn't really need to go on your strangers list. But a little redundancy never hurt anyone, especially in the pursuit of enlightenment.
The Life-Changing Magic of Not Giving a Beep is both written and read by Sarah Knight and is available commercially. That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, you can always find another episode of Read On as a podcast. Well, over 350 episodes on your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read on Spotify, Google, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can email the show using radio@rnib.org.uk or find me on Twitter @talking_books.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.